Kneel Before Blog presents Kneel Before Pod.
Hello and welcome to Kneel Before Pod interviews. I'm your host Craig and I recently had the chance to catch up with the cast and crew of The Burning Season ahead of its international premiere at the 2024 Glasgow Film Festival. I did an in-person interview with writer and actor Jonas Chernick, actor Sarah Canning, actor Christian Meier, and director Sean Garrity. The interview was recorded in a busy hotel lobby, so be prepared for some background noise, including someone vacuuming for a short time. The voices you want to hear are still more than audible, though. Sit back, relax, and enjoy.
What we'll do is we'll just start by going around the table and everybody introduce themselves and explain what they did on the film. So we're here to talk about The Burning Season, which is it debuting at Glasgow Film Festival?
International premiere.
Okay, so let's just start with you. Who are you? What did you do in this film?
Hi, I'm Jonas Chernick, and I am the lead actor and co-writer and producer of The Burning Season.
Hello, I'm Sarah Canning, and I play Elena in the film.
Hello, I'm Christian Meier, and I play Benny.
I'm Sean Garrity, and I'm the director of the film.
Let's start from a writing directing point of view. How did this project come about? Where did the idea start?
Well, I was writing another movie with my co-writer, Diana Francis, and it was a love story, a sort of a scenes from a marriage story kind of movie, and we just couldn't crack it. We couldn't get it to the finish line, and I was ready to give up. And then one day she came in to our story session and she pitched me on this very loose idea. It was like, what if we pivot and tell a love story backwards, which isn't unprecedented. And I immediately connected to like a few Harold Pinter's Betrayal and Memento. And I got really excited about exploring a love story that way. And so we integrated a lot of the ideas that we had in our previous version of the script, but then it really took shape and became its own thing and really became about secrets. And for me, it became about looking at the ramifications of secrets, what happens if we hold on to things, how it can destroy us and those around us, and what a fascinating way to look at that backwards, and so that the secret becomes a secret. And there actually was another director attached to the project for years, very close to production. He was unable to direct the film because he had another commitment that kind of went long. And there was only one director, I thought, at this late stage in the game, one guy that I could go to.
Who would be available?
Right, he wasn't available, so I went in the phone book and randomly selected. No, Sean and I have made so many movies together that I thought, this close to the day, it's got to be someone that I trust impeccably. I can't start a new relationship at this point. And Sean and I had lunch, and I pitched him on, do you want to come on board and take this on? And he had read the script years ago, years before that, as a friend, and gave me notes. And he'd liked the script, and he had identified what was missing from the script. And he very articulately shared that with me, and I had been unable to kind of solve that puzzle. Then when he came on board, right away he said, now let's talk about that piece that's missing. And it ended up being a massive piece. It's the whole end of the movie, and we reverse engineered your character was in it before, don't worry, we reverse engineered the whole thing and rewrote the script right before production. Sean and I kind of dug into it, and so Sean's vision of the movie, the version before Sean had come on, was very different.
So the moral of the story is, never go for lunch with a writer who might be looking at picture film. It might end up working.
Yeah, that is the moral of the story.
Yeah. I was interested in the structure of the film. When you were writing it, did you write it linearly, or did you start at the end and work your way back?
I wrote it sequentially and then moved things around.
Okay.
So that the backward storytelling, Sean can tell you more about this, but he decided that that was the way that we should shoot the film as well.
Oh, okay. So shot
sequentially, with the exception of the prologue, which we shot last. We started with chapter one and then chapter two, and so anything that the actors would improvise or that we would change in shooting, we could kind of ripple it through.
It was interesting just getting all the answers, so you see these conversations play out, and you're like, I wonder what's behind that, and getting the answers to them in the next scene almost, or in the next section, or a couple of sections later. That must have been really fascinating to play as actors as well.
Yeah, Sarah, you can speak to that. Because we were shooting it sequentially, it didn't feel the way you're... when you watch the movie, yes, you see something or you hear something in one scene that is disorienting or maybe unexplained, and then if you keep watching it as you roll back in time, in the next scene, the next chapter, it's explained, or the origin of it, or there's more insight. But as actors, because we shot it in order, it didn't have that same effect, I suppose. It just sort of played out normally for us as actors.
Yeah, I think it definitely played out. It was certainly helpful to shoot it the way that we did, but I think that there was still room to kind of layer in there's an inside joke here, or there are things that are unsaid at this moment that may be said later on. And the way that I envision it is almost like really confusing an ellipses of just sort of there's something more to this moment and we're just going to revisit it. I tried to factor that into each chapter of like, okay, this might be part A of this sentence and we'll get part B later, even if part B is subtext. So I just really tried to keep that in mind chapter by chapter.
And you both play these characters that are, let's say, messed up.
That's fair.
What was it like digging into as actors towards this kind of, well, it's a healthy and unhealthy relationship? It's kind of something they both need, but something they shouldn't want in a way.
That was, for me, the most fun, digging into that. Because I only have very functional, very healthy relationships in my life. So to be able
exclusively.
So to be able to explore that, I enjoyed the opportunity of digging into that. I think we all can relate to the idea of being drawn to or pulled towards things that we know aren't good for us. And there's a deliciousness to it that makes it so tantalizing, but that also ends up being a problem. So I could relate to that in other ways in my life, and it was a lot of fun applying that to Sarah's character and being able to play those scenes. Being able to play the opposites in the same moment, which is, I want to kiss you and I want to push you away. It kind of infused every moment almost that we got to play together, and there's a lot of energy in that, and I think we found a lot of meat on the bone to wrestle with as actors.
I think for myself it also involved a lot of trust in Sean and Sean's vision for the film. I'm not going to give anything away, but even though I had an idea in my head of what we're working towards and seeing in the prologue with Christian and Natalie's characters, even though I knew what that needed to mean for my character, and we had talked a lot about what her coping mechanisms are, once we got to shooting the actual thing, the crux of the film, where we see where this bond formed and why it did, I had a moment of looking at Sean and going, I don't know, did I mess up everything? I don't know if I got anything right. And Sean reassured me that we're dealing with a character who has a very specific lens on life and a very specific forward driving motion in order to deal with traumatic things that have happened to her. So it was really fun. It was really fun to make sense of what Jonas's character is for Elena and how that evolves and devolves. It was just such a joy. Like you say, it's messy to mess about in that. And also try to maintain some structure of what's happening right now, what happened last year, what happened last year that makes this moment, this particular kind of messy, or they're trying to be cleaner, or whatever.
Which was helped by the fact that Sean structured the production in a way that we shot it chronologically.
Yeah.
And I think was part of his design. That would have been much more complicated to track as actors, because by nature there's a, it's not repetitive, but the characters wrestle with similar ideas in each chapter that are informed by what comes before. So we were able to post on that in a way.
I guess the setting must have helped with that, the structure of it, because it seems like a very static setting. It's the idea of this place never changes, but the people that come every year do. I'm guessing that made it easier for continuity reasons to shoot it chronologically in that way.
Yeah, I think there is an idea of it becomes easier to track changes in people when the only thing that changes are the people.
Yeah.
The setting stays the same, and so you're really drawn to the differences, sometimes very subtle, year over year. Although if you were to watch chapter 1 and then chapter 7 of this film, you'd see vast differences, of course, between them. But I think that setting really helped in a way to sort of focus on the thing that we wanted to focus on. And the setting that we chose as well, we chose to be a place that could host this story, that has some shadows and some darkness and some passages, and a place where Jonas and I talked about it a lot when we were scouting locations, a place where secrets could live, which is what that place was about.
Yeah, it's very isolating. It's unsettling in a way because you're almost stuck there when you're there, and there's almost no escape. So they have to talk about these things, don't they? Because they can't avoid it. They're stuck together. They're thrown in this location that's miles from anywhere sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think in chapter four, they make a vow at the beginning of the chapter to not see each other. But of course, there's nobody else there, and they're in the middle of the bush, so their vow doesn't last long. So yeah, you're absolutely right. And the camp that we shot at, was a camp for rich kids.
Oh, wow.
Still is a camp for rich kids. Such, I should say, notable rich kids as Justin Trudeau once stayed there as a kid.
Oh, wow. He's the Prime Minister of Canada. For your listeners that might not be
for anyone who's nowhere.
Yes.
We're world leaders. Don't know where Canada is.
Right, and depending when this plays. Prime Minister of Canada at the moment.
And a very famous artist, Tom Thompson, who was...
From the Group of Seven.
Yeah, from the Group of Seven, one of the most famous Canadian painters, or internationally, died near there mysteriously.
Mm-hmm. Was it mysterious?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Really?
Yeah. You don't know the story of
Tom
Thompson's
I don't know the story of Tom Thompson.
Look up, there'll be a link in the show notes, maybe, to the Wikipedia.
I'll leave that with you.
Yeah. When writing the film, were you conscious of the fact that it's possible the characters might end up being unlikable because it's focused on an affair? So it's the idea of they're lying to their partners, they're sneaking around. Is that something you were conscious of, and how did you power through that?
Yes, I was, and I always am. Sean and I, in particular, we've made 7 movies together. We're very interested, whether this is conscious or not, in flawed characters, and often we start our movies with the character, usually me, doing something or behaving in a way that really challenges the audience to get on board. And then we kind of take them on a journey of, now let's watch the possible redemption of the character. Let's get into the character's psychology. I like playing with that. I find those characters are the most interesting. As a filmgoer, I like to see flawed characters. So I'm aware of that, but I'm not overly aware of it. Certainly not as an actor, but as a writer, yeah, I'm telling a story about an illicit affair that is clearly, by all accounts, not supposed to be happening, quote-unquote. But there's something so relatable and intriguing and personal about it that I think people seem to forgive the characters. Like I said, it's sort of universal, this idea of being drawn to something that is bad for you, whether it's fast food or somebody that you're not supposed to be sleeping with, that I find there's just a universality to it, and so people are drawn into it. And I leave it to my brilliant director, Sean Garrity, to gauge that throughout and fine-tune where we are. He's very aware of it, and he'll often try things and have us try things in different ways so that he has something to play with in editing. But yeah, I worry about it only so much, and okay, then I let him worry about it.
It's almost like you're challenging the audience as well, because the two partners are just really nice people as well. Mm-hmm. It's not that she's in a bad relationship, it's not that he's in a bad relationship, so it's really almost pointing out that it's clear that these people have been messed about and it's not their fault, but well, we're challenging you to like these
And that
guys,
was a very conscious choice to fully develop and fully flesh out the partners. Because it would be easy to make the partners boring or evil, and then really there's no conflict. It's like you two should be together. And Sean was integral in really helping me find that part of the story of, like, why can't these two be together? Why don't they just leave their partners and be together? And so ultimately you're building to the end of the movie, which explains or casts insight or sheds light on the psychological reason for why these two shouldn't or cannot be together. But making sure that the partners were viable options, I think, was integral.
And Sarah, your character is interesting because she was almost afraid of how healthy her relationship was, but there's also the corporateness of his job as well. When she lets him go away to deal with some emergency, it seems like the idea of, I'm happy being secondary to this job almost. It's almost that I don't deserve this aspect of it.
Yeah, that's very insightful. I think that there's a level of addiction present for both characters, absolutely, in some similar ways and also some very different ways. I think there is read a lot about and maybe experienced by proxy. I think there can be an unwillingness to let go of certain states of discomfort or uncertainty. I think sometimes it can be very hard to trust the thing that clearly seems like the answer. I think there can be real meaning created out of chaos or a certain lens on life that if you were to let go of that and then just kind of melt into a warm bath of the right answer, I think that can seem really scary for people in many different circumstances and situations. And I think some of that was present for Elena. And I think the bond that they have is... I actually sometimes feel a little conflicted using the word bond, but I think that is what it is to them. I think there's something about it that is really terrifying to break, because I think that would, to Elena, probably feel like a lot of dominoes that are lined up and really precariously balanced. I don't know.
Isn't it consistent with trauma or with survivors of trauma that they, in a twisted way take comfort in the thing that causes them mm-hmm. pain or that becomes a ramification of PTSD or of having experienced something traumatic.
Because it's such a strong skeletal structure in their life as well, I think, sometimes that it just feels, well, if that's gone, what am I? What is left? It's such a defining thing in life sometimes.
Yeah. You know? And then you only really see them when they're on holiday as well. You don't see what their lives are like outside of that.
That's right.
You're piecing it together based on just how they interact, which I find really interesting.
But I loved that about the film. I love that Joe and Takesha play these really beautiful, rounded, funny, sweet, really beautiful characters. That's one of my favorite things about the film, is that those characters aren't compromised, like you say, in a, well, let's make this obvious, let's let the sympathy sit with the two people who can't give each other up. It just adds to the complexity of the entire thing.
I do have to ask, what was shooting the bat scene though? That seemed like it might have been a challenge.
No, it wasn't a challenge at all. It was actually really fun. I'm not sure, because we've actually talked about this in interviews where Christian has not been present. People talk about what an amazing job he did of being young Jonas.
Yeah.
You guys were hanging out on set a bit before that, kind of watching from the sideline. Were you consciously trying to imitate some of the ways...
People have asked us in interviews.
Yeah. We kind of go, I think they were doing that.
I don't think that you did. I don't think you were studying my gestures. I think we just... You and I just have a shared energy.
Yeah, I think that's basically it. They found you in casting. And I think maybe some stuff when I just naturally worn off, because we were like camping together basically the whole time. We called each other mini me and older me, and maybe something like that kind of leaked into it. But besides that, no, not really.
They're almost different characters anyway, aren't they? It's two different stages of their life, so you almost have to accept it. He seems way different when he was that age.
Right, because there's a trauma, and one is pre-trauma, and the other is post-trauma, right?
Because he changes his name and everything, so it's like, I am a different person now, I'm not that kid anymore.
And I think going back to like what Jonas and Sarah were saying about the trauma, and I think it's very human, because I think that's just such a comfort place that we all try to go back to, because it's something that we know and we're familiar with, and even if it's pain, we know it. So yeah, I think it plays really well in the film.
And when we were reworking that scene, when I came on and asked for script changes, they were focused at the end. That's where we did most of our work. And I think these two characters, the young versions of our heroes, are really encoding the trauma that they will spend the rest of the movie dealing with, when speaking chronologically. And so we were very conscious of putting reckless teenage choices in the script, and lots of them. And I was very interested in the idea, as a dad, that kids make selfish, stupid, reckless choices because they're kids. Then they blame themselves for the rest of their days, especially if they were choices that they made as teenagers. We all remember things that we did that we feel very guilty and terrible about when we were teenagers. But with a wider lens, you sort of go, right, but you're a kid. You're kind of biologically designed to make stupid, reckless choices. And as a result of that, Jonas really wrote a lot of those in the later drafts just before production of the script, of these choices that these kids make where they're just like, let's run away, let's fuck everything and go, let's burn the house down, like these crazy things that they suggest that come to them.
And then the incident itself, that would be an amplified stupid thing doing as a kid. That really makes that point, doesn't it? Really punctuates it.
Well, the consequences are, I mean, how many of us don't have something that we did in our youth that we were part of in some way that turned out terribly? So many times we just managed to escape by the hairs of our chinny chin chins. But I mean, sometimes you do something that you're a part of or that you did yourself, and the consequences are horrible, and you just kind of have to find a way to live with that, or in the case of these heroes, or not.
And in terms of shooting the film, was there challenges, because it was mostly outdoors, in terms of getting everything done, making it all look within the right lighting conditions and all that stuff?
No, we just used mostly the big light provided by the gods most of the time. The first ADs never get shout outs in these things. Our first AD, Austin, who was incredible, we managed to plan to shoot things based on where the sun was going to be over the course of a day. So we managed to get scenes at the boathouse where you have the sun just low in the sky behind them over that lake, giving them that brilliant backlight, in which case you kind of don't need any other light. That light comes blasting in from the sun and bounces off everything and creates kind of a glow. And so you don't spend much time lighting because it's lit and you can just move very quickly. And
then you just use whatever take is the best one under those conditions.
Or whatever takes, plural, that you can glue together, gobble together in post.
Rain is often an issue when you're shooting on set. We got very lucky preoccupied with weather. We did have one day where it was sporadic rain, and we kind of used it in the film and referenced it and rewrote some dialogue to make it all make sense.
Yeah, and then in the lead-up I added thunder in the background,
right.
So it feels like it's coming in.
And then the wedding scene that opens the movie was not supposed to be under a tent. It was supposed to be out in the open, but then we had rain.
It rained
that day, so...
I prefer the tent.
These things tend to happen in filmmaking. The shark in Jaws, or whatever. I'm not comparing us to Jaws, but kind of it ends up being a happy accident, because I think the idea of it raining on this particular wedding day couldn't be more apt.
Yeah, when they're giving their vows and stuff, and then we added a bunch in post. Pouring rain and thunder.
We always hear that on location shoots where, this disaster happened, and we just have to deal with it, and we change things around, the adaptable aspect of it.
And there's this idea of the open door. Bernardo Bertolucci talked about the open door, that when something doesn't go the way you expect, a door opens to another possible version of that scene. And it's very exciting to choose to go through that door. It's funny, I did a thing recently, I know Sarah, you did one of these because we watched earlier ones that were done, where we were shooting with this sci-fi wall that they use for The Mandalorian.
The LED wall, yeah.
Yeah, the LED wall. So we shot a scene with the LED wall, and you get none of that with that wall. There's no sudden like, oh wait, the scene could be totally different.
No.
Because something has been suggested by the weather or a change in light or whatever. It's just you get exactly what you planned and you execute the plan and you walk out. There's something kind of less spontaneous about it in the end.
Yeah.
That's what I find when it's obvious that we've shot on something like that. Okay, it looks good, but you don't get any of the natural flourishes you get. People's hair blowing in the wind or whatever. People sweating even just because it's warm outside. That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Seems
you lose. And great actor. Like these, all three of these guys, when something like that happens in front of the camera, they work it into the scene and it becomes a new thing.
This is why I'm not worried about... I don't watch the Marvel movies. This is why I'm not worried about AI, because I think we will always crave and desire this kind of humanity in cinema.
Yeah.
And that as much as you can create on a green screen and with AI and actors being replaced by composite drawings or whatever, it's just not the same. And it doesn't leave you feeling the same way. And I think some people are aware of that now and some people aren't, but I think that will always be an element for us.
I think even if they're not aware of it, audiences can sort of unconsciously tell and lift you out of it a little bit when it doesn't feel quite real. This person clearly isn't there. Don't connect with it in the same way.
Well, the pendulum's swinging back, and I don't watch the Marvel movies, and I'm sure it's a huge part of your life, but if the last few just, they have not been successful and it's starting to change.
I acknowledge that there's a bit of a quality dip in terms of how they're making them, in terms of how they're being received, all that stuff. As much as I love that stuff, I do also acknowledge the fact that it's not what it used to be.
Well, because ultimately spectacle is, it's spectacle, but if it's missing all the other stuff, then it's just spectacle, and I think we'll get bored of it eventually, and maybe we already are.
Yeah, so from that point of view, it's refreshing to see something that was filmed outside with
real people.
Our other writer, Diana, was really battling raccoons to keep them away from the snack table.
We found that one of our great challenges shooting out there was that we had many, many other crew members, four-legged crew members.
Walking away with craft service.
All kinds of things.
And were bugs a problem?
I don't remember bugs being a big problem.
I don't remember any of that.
No.
It was end of the season.
Yeah, it was late in the season, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, and it's not really a buggy... part of Canada. You go further west to get really bad bugs, or north, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. What was really beautiful was that part of Canada starts to change color in September. Really change color. In fact, right at the end of our shoot is what they call a leaf season, and tourists come from all over the world to see this gigantic provincial park we were shooting in, because it turns yellow and red and orange and purple. And we gradually got to watch that as our drive into set every day over the course of a month. We got to see it. And the way, again, Sean structured the shoot is that it ended with the prologue with our characters as teenagers. Mm-hmm. And by then, the colors are popping and it's the feeling of change in the air. So it was beautiful to watch all the colors changing.
And you see that in the film. There's a lot of beautiful shots of just the whole area where the story's mostly based.
So with the prologue being shot last, were you around for most of the shoot and see how...
No, we went down to the park for around 10 days. Natalie Jane and I, my co-star, amazing. And was it?
They came at the end.
We were quite far. We were about, a 4-hour drive from Toronto?
3.5-4-hour drive from Toronto in a very small town that had very little resources or supplies.
We all had a place to stay, but we all sort of played musical, because even putting that many crew and cast up in a place of that size is...
There are advantages to shooting somewhere that doesn't have the history of filmmakers being there, because everybody in that town, in that region, was so excited to be having a film shoot there that we had incredible things happen, like, oh, we need to burn down a building. Well, the fire department's excited to help us with that. And the fire chief in the region got really involved, Ian Collins.
Just see you as a nuisance.
And for the prologue, we needed a bunch of old 90s cars. Yeah. And I mentioned to someone, I was like, oh, I've seen a yellow VW Beetle driving around. They're like, oh, yeah, that's Amanda's. She works at the service station. You could go ask her. Any car we would see, we would ask who owned it, and they'd tell us who owned it, and we'd go to their house.
And they'd throw us the keys.
Yeah,
they'd say, just bring it back when you're done. Brilliant. That doesn't happen in Toronto.
Yeah, because no one has a car that's older than 2 years old.
And Toronto. Because they're too savvy. They'd be like, right. You want to use it in your movie, huh? $2,000 a minute.
Seeing the difference between the UK and North America, you talk about being 4.5 hours away as if it's nothing, but here it's the whole country.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
right.
That's the funny thing about Canada, is it really is nothing. We all take 4 or 5 hour trips off. We're just getting out of the city if we go 5 hours.
That's right.
Right. I was telling Jonas, actually, I was in a bar with a guy last night in Edinburgh who was talking a lot about death, but when he finished that, his name was Alan, lovely guy. He did say, though, that in Europe, 100 kilometers is a long way, and in North America, 100 years is a long time.
That's a common phrase.
That's right.
It's like,
is it
a common thing people all say that? Yeah.
I've never heard that before.
Really
That's a very good point.
Okay, so what I usually do to close off an interview is ask people what superpower they'd have and why. You answered that last time I interviewed you, but you
what did I say?
I can't remember. Oh. And I didn't bother looking back to find out. But you can answer again. Maybe it's changed, maybe it's not. We can revisit and see if you have the same answer.
Fly. It was probably to fly. I often have lucid dreams, and that's what I do is I take off and fly around.
Cool.
Okay. Sarah, superpower?
I think mine would be very weird.
Not tentacles.
Oh. I think
turn into a goat at will.
That's weird. I think mine would involve time in some way, because I find, even though I try to be extremely mindful, I just feel the pace at which time moves is. So I don't know if it would be time travel or being able to take 5 minutes and expand it into a day, but I'm sure I'd mess with a lot of people's lives if I did that. I don't know.
Time manipulation.
You freeze time and suddenly find that you're like 90 years old and it's only been a week.
Right, it'd be like Inception and they come back from the planet. Oh, whoops. There goes 70
years. That's a good one. It's a rare one. People don't tend to like to mess with time.
That would be
fine. What
about yourself? There's a new show out called Avatar The Last Airbender. Yeah. And I grew up on that show as well. So I think waterbending.
Cool.
Yeah. Nice.
That is nice. My superpower would be an internal alarm that would warn me before I say something that's going to piss off my wife. Like, just before I say it, I'd get a little like, beep, 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 watch out.
Don't say that.
That would be a very useful one for me.
Every time you say something, though.
Yeah, maybe I'd just be silent as a result of that alarm.
Very good.
Good answer. I've never had that one before.
Very good.
Well, guys, thanks very much for your time. This has been great. Actually, it's one of my rare in-person interviews. It almost never happens. So it's been great chatting. And I love the film, so I hope it does really well.
Thank you.
I'm seeing your work again in your future.
Thanks, Craig. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was my interview with Jonas Czernik, Sarah Canning, Christian Meier, and Sean Garrity. We wish them all the best for the film and all future projects. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere you get your podcasts. If you want to discuss anything you heard here or anything else, you can hit us up on Facebook, Twitter/X, or Blue Sky under Neil Before Blog. You can also leave us a comment on neilbeforeblog.co.uk. You can also join us on Discord if you want a direct line to us. For more interviews, a monthly news podcast, and in-depth analytical discussions about your favourite nerdy things, please continue to join us on Neil Before Pod.